Good day, everyone, and welcome to New Matter, the SLAS podcast where we interview life science luminaries. I'm your host, SLAS Scientific Director Marshall Brennan, and today we're chatting with former SLAS Scientific Director Mike Tarcelli, who is now the CSO of Tetra Science. How are you doing, Mike?
I am doing fantastic, Marshall. Congratulations on the new job.
Well, congratulations on yours, too.
Thank you. It's very kind of you.
So for listeners in the audience, Mike and I go very far back. So this may be a more casual conversation than normal. But in any case, Mike is a great guest, and I'm really looking forward to talking to him. But it is SLAS tradition. We do have to have you describe your day-to-day work in 10 words or fewer as a matter of rite of passage. So can you do it, Mike?
Fantastic. I prepared exactly for this. So open quote, I help scientists do more with their diverse data, end quote.
Excellent. All right. Well, I was a bit of a low ball because again, you know, you used to run these yourself. So that's fair. Tell us a little bit about how you got to where you are and, you know, what path brought you through and out of the other side of SLAS into Tetra Science. I'm really curious about, you know, the humble origins of our former scientific director.
That's nice of you. I was born on a planet far, far away and exposed to Earth's yellow sun at a young age and then found out that I had superpowers. No. In reality, I was born in Allentown, Pennsylvania, and my family moved up to Massachusetts when I was very young. And from a young age, they told me, hey, you seem to like medicine and math and science. Maybe you want to be a doctor, like the real kind of doctor. And I kept thinking to myself, yeah, doctor, doctor. So I took anatomy and I took pre-med. I did all that stuff. Went to college and did an EMT course. So that's an emergency medical technician, if no one's from the US. And that's something where you go out and save people in ambulances and check them in at clinics and look at emergency situations in a hospital setting. And I realized very soon, I didn't like blood. It's unfortunate. I actually passed out. And when you pass out as a 6 foot tall, very large human being, you hit the ground pretty hard. So... you can't really be a doctor under those conditions.
You chose to be the less useful kind of doctor.
There we go. The same kind
that I am. Yeah.
There you go. So I went to my advisors and I said, I really still want to help people with healthcare, but I can't be a doctor. What can I do? And they said, well, you could go into medicinal chemistry. And I said, I don't know what that is because I don't come from a family where everybody has these kind of backgrounds. So I went to a pharma internship. I went from there to graduate school when I learned that it was difficult to advance in pharma, at least in that time, without a PhD. And then I called back and said, hey, I want to be a med chemist in industry again. And they said, well, you can't do that unless you have a postdoc. And I went, what the heck's a postdoc? So ended up at Scripps for a postdoc, got out of that, and I called them back in, I think it's the bottom of 29 or 2010. And I said, hey, can I have my old job back? And they said, it's the middle of the Great Recession. Everybody's frozen. So sorry. And I went and realized that I had just done, 8 years of post-secondary education and didn't have a job to show for it. So you did what anybody could.
For our listeners, that's a common experience. So don't, yes, don't feel like this is out of the ordinary, but especially at that time, like finishing your postdoc and sort of figuring out what will my life become is a common phenomenon.
So I did what I could do, which was I took a job in a contract research organization in the mountains of North Carolina. And then from there, joined a startup in New Haven, Connecticut. Everybody loves Sal's Pizza. There you go. And then that went up and then went down, ran out of funding. And I joined Novartis by happenstance because of an interest in data science and in collaboration. Worked there for about 5 years, had a large global team. We rolled out a lot of collaboration apps to help sort of the general scientific populace do things faster and better. And then I found myself at SLAS because there was an amazing opportunity to help a very broad range of scientists learn, and I couldn't pass it up.
That is an excellent story. And I do want to ask you about a little bit of your history in more detail before we get on to your current role. So you mentioned that you sort of got into... the data science at Novartis, kind of coincidentally, right? Could you tell me, did you have any experience in that area? What did you do to prepare? How was that transition? Just tell me what it was like making the transition from a would-be medicinal chemist to a data scientist at Novartis.
Sure. So as everyone listening to this who practices at a bench right now or does automation engineering for a living knows, I mean, you still do data science in your spare time, right? You take in data, you publish things to your ELN, you do statistics on the data that's in an assay database, you are pushing data back and forth across systems. So you end up with sort of a education by fire, right? I learned SQL queries so I could communicate with instruments and get data back. I learned a little bit of Python so I could write some scripts, you know, basic stuff. I learned HTML, I think 3 at that point, whew, I'm old, to construct web pages for the department. So you just sort of agglomerate it over time. And then you realize midway through your career that you can actually function as an information scientist, which is a title you did not accrue to yourself before. And then people go, well, you know, there's this data over here and we need it to go over there. And it doesn't get standardized or transposed or harmonized or anything. Can you help? And you go, how much? And they say, oh, you know, 100 gigs. And you say, oh, just that? And then the problem snowballs from there and you learn that you actually have a job and that other people have jobs in this space too. That's how it happened, sort of slowly, organically.
I see. I mean, that's a really great way to put it. And I think part of what's important to recognize about that too is that, you know, seeing opportunities in what you're doing that may not be obvious, right? So like the logical leap there is I don't think most people would see what they're doing, you know, at the bench as data science, but really it's a part of the fundamental core of what we're doing, which is why, you know, we love supporting it at SLIS, right? And so recognizing that and really leaning into it, I think was an opportunity that, you know, you seized and I hope more people seize as they move on in their careers.
Yeah, just for context on that, since we're here for a minute, I would tell you that the data volume isn't going anywhere. And if anything, it's increasing exponentially. I know we humans with our sort of primate brains don't really do exponents well, but let's just say the internet passed 1 exabyte. That's way bigger than a terabyte or a petabyte just about 10 years ago. And it's set to hit about 15 or 16 exabytes next year. And then it's going to be 20 2 or 3 years after that. It is going way faster than we can wrangle it. And that's going to be an increasing problem for science.
Yeah. So one useful way of thinking about the difference between these orders of magnitudes. So we think about even something small, like the difference between 1 million and 1 billion, right? So for our listeners who are having trouble imagining the difference between some of these huge numbers, the difference between 1 million seconds and 1 billion seconds is that 1 million seconds is 11 days and 1 billion seconds is over 31 years. And so when you then go from 1 billion to 1 trillion and 1 trillion up the chain up till you get to these bigger, to the point where you're getting to exabytes, it truly is a mind-boggling big number that, you know, you just can't put a scale to. And so I'm going to go out on a limb and say that you might have something to say about this sort of volume of data slash how we handle it at your day job now, right?
Yeah, I mean, the big data of lab automation, screening, and visualization is still what I would consider an unsolved problem. There are certainly pieces. I'm not going to tell you that it's, you know, not been touched, because there are hundreds of companies operating in this space. You've probably heard of many of them before. There's companies that handle your electronic lab notebook, that handle your LIMS, that handle your data architecture behind the scenes. There's plenty of instruments, and each one has its very own software package that you have to learn. But it's so many and such different data formats that you kind of get into the point where there has to be like a meta role in your lab of he or she who drives instruments for a living. You know, you learn all the software packages and all the bells and whistles of, you know, the spectrometer and also the viscometer and also the mass spec because you need to. And you teach all those things to sing together in harmony and get your data to where it needs to go so your scientists can do things. Some people call these core facilities directors or automation engineers. And this role is getting increasingly important and increasingly difficult to train for, because how do you prepare for that, right? You've gotta be a scientific domain expert and an automation expert and a data scientist and understand where the data is landing and how to transfer it. It's too much for one person. So we, Tetra Science, where I am currently the CSO, we help this by smoothing out that last bit. What are you going to do with that data once you have it? So we theorize that what people often lay out of this procedure is they don't build the pipes. They don't build the infrastructure behind the scenes. People often want to be on the front end, here's the piece of software that gets the data off the instrument. or they want to be on the back end. Hey, create me a beautiful visualization or graph that shows what I'm doing. But very few people want to be in the middle. How do you get the data from that instrument program over to the target? So we're going to build you pipes. We're going to help you take that data off instruments. We're going to pipeline it, AKA we're going to process it, do something with it, and then we're going to publish it wherever you need it to be pushed. And that's really our company's business. And we're trying really hard to connect everything to us so that you don't have to connect everything to everything, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it harkens back to some other interviews we've had recently. How do you solve the challenge of the fact that, you know, every instrument in a lab, you know, you're lucky if you can get two instruments from the same company to use the same format of file, let alone from two different companies. How do you resolve that issue? What's the secret sauce to getting these various machines to talk nice with one another, since that seems to be your special sauce?
It's funny you say that, because our special sauce is not special at all. It's actually an open format. If anybody here is listening who's a data engineer or likes to play on the web, JavaScript, right? It has a format called JavaScript Object Notation, or JSON, and it's very common on the web. When you go to Amazon or you go to Enterprise Rent-A-Car and you look at a form where you can choose a car or choose a present, that form is likely a JSON object behind the scene. And it's basically a hierarchical list. It's saying, show me a list of cars, list of cars by brand, list of cars by brand with these features. That same kind of object can be used to describe lab instruments. So you can say, what's up, mass spec? Give me this data back. Log its time, temperature, experiment, the individual pulses or intensities per time, etc. And you can basically organize that into this hierarchy. And then you say, hey, look, we've harmonized all the mass specs from all the vendors into this mass spec object, right? And that way, because every instrument's going to write a different format, we don't care. We'll just take the raw data, we'll put it into our object, and then we can push that object to so many different programs, because lots of things are written to interpret JSON. So we call this an intermediate data schema, IDS. And my God, I feel very jargony. So let's just say it's not a standard, but it is definitely a way to have everything talk in one language.
Yeah, no, and that's fantastic, because, like, you know, when we think about the modern web, you know, JavaScript powers a lot of it. And it sounds like you're drawing a lot of the same tools that, you know, developers would build to create, you know, let's talk about, you know, single page web applications. You know, it's the same sort of, sounds like the same sort of architecture that you'd use to get, you know, your mobile app front end to talk to your MongoDB server. Now, one thing that I'm curious about, and there, you know, I suspect that the answer is probably pretty simple, but you're describing working primarily in a JavaScript workflow. And I think most of the lab scientists that I've talked to tend to work in Python. Is there a good rationale for why you might or might not choose one over the other? Like, what's your philosophy over taking this JavaScript, you know, web-friendly approach over one of the packages that you might find more commonly in the lab?
Sure. So I'll be clear about this. It's not an either or, it's an and. Mm-hmm. We interpret it into JavaScript objects because it's easy to take it from there. And if somebody wants to use Python or build a Python pipeline to do data science beyond there, hey, knock yourself out. You can use Python to query this data, because all the JavaScript is, it's an object. It's a way of looking at a list of things from that instrument or from that data source. So Python can then be used downstream to be like, hey, look across every mass spec I have or every cell counter I have, bring me back these three fields and organize them on these three axes. Great. Go nuts. Knock yourself out. Show me the result in Spotfire. And we can help you write that, or you can write it yourself. We honestly are very agnostic to what you want to do with the data, but we're going to give you all the data in that format.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for that description of, you know, everything you guys are working on.
Sure. Hope everyone's still awake.
Yeah, you did a good job of making sure that the TLAs were well explained. So, you know, that's most we can ask for. And so for the folks who I was lost on that last TLA, that's a three-letter acronym.
That's it.
So we're getting close to the end of the time that, you know, we have you for, and, you know, every moment is precious. So I'm going to move on to trying to get some advice from you for our younger scientists. So we talked about your path to get to where you are. And like most of us, I think it was less of a straight line than you probably imagined when you, you know, showed up at your first day of college orientation, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. So if you're going to give any advice to students who are just getting started out in this really rich area and are looking at the landscape of their career, what can they do now to prepare themselves best for the sorts of careers that you're in or this evolving landscape that, you know, Tetra Science is part of creating?
Sure. So first thing to realize is I think that the old subdivisions of science that we sort of inherited from the Greeks, the Romans, and then the imperial system are kind of gone. Mm-hmm. Very few people are actually straight up chemists, biologists, physicists, computer scientists anymore. Those distinctions are a little arbitrary. You're usually a chemist who controls biological systems using physics tools, or you're a physicist who studies geological processes using mathematical models, right? There's interdisciplinary everywhere. So I would say I would get a little bit away from the deep specialist education of saying, I got to take Chem, OChem, Analytical Chem, PChem, PChem 3, OChem Advanced. You could probably get a general idea and level of skill going into your undergraduate courses, and then you could use little electives or little internships to expand your knowledge into the next thing. Where's your passion at? You know, do you want to save the world a certain way? Do you want to do drugs that perfuse into tissues? Okay, you're going to need to know something about physics, desorption, right? Absorption. You're going to need to know something about biology, how the cells are going to respond. You need to know about chemistry for the drug. You're going to need to know about human anatomy for where you inject it, right? You're going to need to sample from a lot of different fields to get done what you want to get done. So I would say as interdisciplinary and as diverse as you can make your interests, and then to find a niche where other people don't operate, but that you can be expert in. People are creating new fields every day, Marshall. So technically speaking, I'm a CSO of a tech company that handles integrations underneath scientific instruments, right? That role probably didn't exist 10 years ago. So prepare for the things that you're going to do in 10 years, not for the things that are now.
I think that that echoes a lot of the sentiments that I give to students too, because it's so easy to fall into the trends that are happening now. And if that was what all I did when I was in school, then I'd be working on CH activation of nanoparticles, right? Whereas, right, you know, the conversation has evolved so much, you know, even just a few years, you know, out from my own PhD. So that's really sage advice. And I really hope the students among us are taking notes. All right, last question. And this is a quick one. When we're finally able to get back together in person and you're attending your first SLAS meeting in, you know, in the flesh, who are you most likely to ask to coffee first?
Funny story. It will actually be my third in-person SLAS because I did get to work two of them in my former role. But yes, when I'm finally back into the SLAS community, shaking hands and talking science, I can't wait to catch up with members of the Knowledge Content and Delivery Council. They are the brains and the strategy of SLAS, and they really keep us on the path of what kind of fields are coming up next. I miss working with them day to day. I also miss the amazingly detailed and action-oriented SLAS staff, so I would definitely take them all out for a beer. And then finally, I would say I want to get back on that vendor floor because, I mean, there's nothing like that hum of a bunch of different auto-injectors, instruments, et cetera, all going at once. You really can't match it. So I want those three things in order.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Mike. Where can our listeners go to learn more about you?
Sure. They can certainly go on our company site, www.tetrascience, T-E-T-R-A, science.com. They can also go to my LinkedIn page, search Tarcelli. I'm the only Tarcelli in all of science, best as my knowledge. So please find me, connect with me, ask me questions. I love to hear things I don't know about or that stump me so I can go learn more. So please engage me and I will help you best I can.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Mike, for being here. And thank you, listeners, for joining us on New Matter today. Until next time, we'll talk to you later.
Thank you.